Bob to get him to come and meet with Bill, because he wouldn't have, and he wasn't going to come and meet with Bill. But because he came home, as they say, with a potted plant and potted himself the day before and ruined Mother's Day, when she said, Bob, please come and meet this man at Henrietta's house, what could he say? I mean, what could he possibly say? And so I love that story, and I know y'all know it. And of course, when we tell stories in Alcoholics Anonymous, we tell them, they may or may not be the truth. My priest says everything is in the Bible is true. Some of it actually happened. And that's how it is in Alcoholics Anonymous. So this is my version of the story, okay, which is that Bob and had been coming to the Oxford group meetings in Akron for 2.5 years and not saying much and not staying sober. And he would leave those meetings and he would go home and get drunk. And he did that for a long time. And he read a lot and he knew a lot. You've read his story. He says that, you know, and I'm an intellectual alcoholic myself. I like to read and figure stuff out, you know, but he was not staying sober. And so finally the group had this technique they used where they would, when somebody was having a problem, they would pray about what they maybe could do to help that person. And so they prayed about what they might be able to do to help Bob. And they got an inkling that they would tell their own stories and perhaps he would tell his story. You know, perhaps he would talk about what his problem was. And it worked because they told their stories. I don't know how many of them there were. And finally he told his story and he talked about the drinking and he talked about how he couldn't stay sober. And I got to tell you, I admitted my alcoholism the first time in a blackout. And that sucker worked. I have no memory of what I said to that woman. Thank God she remembered and came back and told me what I said. But that was the first weekend in May of 1980. And June 17th, I had my last drink. And I believe that those two events are connected. Me being honest, even though I was in a blackout and don't remember it, and me having my last drink. And the same thing happened to Dr. Bob. I don't think he was blacked out. I don't know. But he admitted his alcoholism to these people. And within 30 days, Henrietta got a phone call from a guy she did not know from Adam's house cat, who said, I'm Bill Wilson and I'm a rum hound from New York. And she said to him, you can hear it on the tape in Akron, you are the answer to our prayer. You are the answer to our prayer. And he walked, and I've ridden in the bus from the coach house to the Mayflower Hotel, but Bill walked it that day. He had no money, you know, he had those long legs, but I can just imagine him making that walk from the Mayflower Hotel to Henrietta's coach house. And she talked to him and she called Ann. And like I said earlier, you know, Bob was drunk and that wasn't going to happen. But the next day, and I think Bill walked back to the hotel and came back the next day. And the rest is why we're here. You know, we're here because those two men sat down and they talked to each other. And Bob heard for the first time from the lips of another alcoholic what was wrong with him, what his problem was. See, and that's been the burning question in my mind my whole life is, what is wrong with me? What the heck? I mean, I don't want to be this person. I don't want to be like this. My mother didn't raise me, you know, to be able to walk into a bar with no money and come out drunk. She did not raise that person. I just have a gift. You know, if it has anything to do with alcohol, I stayed drunk one entire summer. I don't know where the money came from. I had no job. I didn't get any unemployment insurance till the end of the summer. And yet every day there was a bottle of sangria and a can of refried beans and some tortilla shells so I could feed my kids. Every day I think God gives us what we need, and I needed to be drunk on sangria that whole summer. And so that's what happened, you know? But I wish I was good at something that was worthwhile or valuable, but you know, what can I say? So these two men got together and they shared experience, strength, and hope. Bill shared experience, strength, and hope with Bob, and he answered that question. This is what's wrong with me. He didn't say this is what's wrong with you. He said, this is what's wrong with me. Maybe it's the same for you. Maybe you have the same problem I have. And Bob was skeptical, I think. He talks about that in his story. And he didn't stay sober. He went along for a while, and they moved Bill into the golf course, I think to the country club, and into Bob's house for a while. And he was there for a while. So on Mother's Day, May 12th was when it was in 1935. And May 12th, and then sometime in June, Bob went to the AMA convention, and he got drunk. Well organized by noon, I think he says that. I love the idiosyncratic way that Bob speaks. He cracks me up. I love the way he talks, and he got drunk and he came back home, and they decided, we've been talking about spiritual stuff. We've been, you know, ruminating on it and intellectualizing about it and all of this. And I guess we're going to have to do something about it, because what we've been doing doesn't seem like it's working. Well, he got it a lot faster than I did, I got to tell you, folks, because I have a big ego and I know stuff. I'm smart. Well, I don't think, I don't know if I'm smart. I'm not smart in useful ways, but my dad used to tell me if I had a brain, I'd be dangerous. And why didn't I use my head for something besides a hat rack? But I think I know stuff. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I knew stuff. And the truth is, I knew nothing. I knew nothing. I did not know. I said I was an alcoholic at my first meeting because I was afraid if I didn't do that, you would kick me out. And the truth is, I did not even know what an alcoholic is. I thought I was a saint with a drinking problem, is what I thought, how I described myself. A type 5 alcoholic, in the doctor's opinion, you know, friendly, able, intelligent, normal in every respect, except for the drinking thing. And none of that is true, it turns out, after I get honest. But that's who came here. That's who came to Alcoholics Anonymous, was a snobbish, bratty, smart alecky, scared to death woman who just put up this big front, put up all these walls and this big front so that you couldn't get in here and see what was really going on with me. The only thing that I can remember in my life that made me feel like a human being was booze. You know, when it worked, oh God, wasn't that heaven? You know, when it worked, alcohol is not a beverage for me, and probably not for you either if you're sitting in this room. Alcohol is transformational for me. I mean, it changes me. It turns me into a goddess is who it turns me into. Now you can tell by looking at me that is not true, but that's how I feel when I drink, you know, and when it's working, that's how I feel. And if I could stop there at whatever point that is, you know, where you're just a goddess and you find some guy who thinks you are a goddess also, that works out really well. You know, if you could just stop there, then, you know, everything would be perfect, but I don't stop. I can't stop there. I'm a pig. I drink and I get as much of it in me as I can get in me. And I'm a puker, and I'm a, you know, I didn't start blacking out immediately, but I got there also. And I don't know what it is about that, but the front end of that, you know, that's what I love. I love that feeling when I'm good enough and I'm pretty enough and I'm sexy enough and I'm okay in my own skin. And I mean, I don't know what would have happened to me if I hadn't gotten that relief. I don't know. I might have been a teenage suicide because my life was not going well when I got to that first drink. I'm the oldest by death, actually. I have a sister who drowned in an irrigation ditch before I was born. And my parents, if you can imagine what my parents were going through after that loss, I got to tell you, it took me until this fall to really get the full effect of what they went through. Because I'm a real alcoholic. See, I'm a real one. I am, as Dick Martin used to say, I'm not much, but I'm all I think about. And I think I am the victim in this scenario. You know, a child is dead. The parents are, well, my mother was home alone with her. She walked into an irrigation ditch and they found her body like 2 weeks later, like 8 miles down the ditch. And I think about it as a mom today. I think about what my mother must have gone through. And I just can't even imagine. My dad helped in the search. I mean, thank God he didn't find her. I think about it now. It's like I have a whole different perspective because for my whole life, you know, I was the victim. I was the one who was harmed. Can you even believe? I mean, I'm just telling you this because this is just an example of what kind of, self-centered, self-obsessed person that we're talking about here. And that's who I am. You know, that's who I am. And if I'm not that today, it's because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's no other reason for it. So I go through my life, you know, telling the sad story about how my sister drowned in an irrigation ditch and how awful it was for me. I wasn't even there, you know, it was awful. It was awful for the people who were there. They moved out of that house pretty close after that because you can't live in the house where that happened, you know. And they moved up the Rattlesnake in Missoula, and I was born in October of 1948. And my mother, you know, wrapped me in cotton batting and protected me and sheltered me. And that's another thing about me that's so screwed up is I do not receive that as love. I do not think this means she loves me. I do not know that this means that she's scared to death, that something's going to happen to me. What I do with this is they wish that she had lived and I was dead. And I mean, nobody said that, you know, and nobody acted like that. But that's how I, you know, this is how I interpret stuff in my little pre-alcoholic brain. And so I just, go along with this thinking. I'm being punished. They are punishing me by protecting me and sheltering me. As soon as I was old enough to take swimming lessons, you can bet your sweet I was in swimming lessons, you know, I have a vivid memory of being, we were at a picnic with a group of people and the kids were going to go wading in the creek. And I come up to my mother, I bet I wasn't 6 years old yet. And I come up to my mother and I said, the kids are going wading in the creek. And I go wading in the creek. And my mother started to scream. I mean, just started to scream. And I don't know. I don't understand. I think you must be a monster to make your mother scream like that. You know, I just had no, and nobody talked about it either. I found out what happened. I read the newspaper article that was in my sister's baby book when I was old enough to read. I snuck downstairs and opened up that book because nobody talked. There was a picture of her in my parents' bedroom. She's a doll, little blonde, white, curly blonde hair, you know, and here I am, this kind of skinny, awkward, long braids, you know, my mother bought all my clothes too big because they didn't have any money. And I had to wear everything until I was married. But, I just have all this stuff. There was a girl in my class who made fun of me, sent me home crying every day in the second grade, because she was dressed like a little doll. And I was dressed with, you know, my brown Girl Scout Oxfords. The boxes are better looking than the shoes, frankly. And you know, and I just got all this stuff inside of me, and I don't fit in. I don't belong. I just don't feel like a part of anything, my own family. And I'm a cradle Catholic. And, you know, if you even think an impure thought, you might as well do it. So I got after that as quick as I could, because, you know, I'm not going to go to hell for thinking stuff. I'm going to go to hell for doing stuff. And I just, you know, I mean, it's like on the outside, I'm following all the rules and I'm doing all the right things. And on the inside, I'm just this, you know, little monster. I just feel that. I feel like a monster. I feel like nobody else thinks like this. Nobody else feels like this. And, thank God, like I said earlier, for alcohol. And thank God that I had an abnormal reaction to it, because if I had just drank it, like Clancy said, and had to go, blah, 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 you know, I don't know what would have happened to me. I do not know what would have happened to me. But it didn't go, blah, 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 blah. It went boom, you know, it got inside of me, and it changes me. It makes me okay. And I'm just so grateful. One of my sponsees is calling me, and she's going to call me on my phone, so I better turn it on silent. I was in trouble with it almost immediately. I was in trouble with alcohol. I started drinking the end of my senior year. That's the only reason I graduated from high school with honors, because by the time I got to Tech, which is a college in Butte, which is where I started my education, I finished that first year with a 1.9. I mean, I had lots of problems. I couldn't get to class. I had an 8 o'clock calculus class. I can't make it to class 5 days a week. You know that I can't do that. And I'm away from home for the first time. Oh, you can imagine, all hell broke loose. And I had the worst, and it's hard to get a bad reputation in Butte, Montana, because there's lots of loose women in that town, but I managed it. You know what I mean? I managed to have a bad reputation in Butte. And Pete knows about Butte. It's probably mellowed out a lot now, but it was in the 60s, it was wild. And I always say I was raised right, but I turned left. I just was not the good Catholic girl that my mother raised. And first my judgment goes, then my inhibitions go, or vice versa. I'm not sure which one went in which order, but by the time I'm 19, I'm pregnant and not married. And so my son is 53 years old. He just turned 53 in April. And I'm grateful for him. I know I made his life a living hell, but I'll tell you what, I am grateful for him, because I think he kept one foot nailed to the floor for me. I mean, I had to kind of cool my jets, because I had a baby to take care of, you know, and I didn't do a very good job, but I did the best I could at the time. And it did. And that marriage didn't last. I mean, the only reason I married him was because A, I'm pregnant and I think it's his kid, and B, because my parents didn't like him. So that was, you know. So then after I got out of that, I decided to go back to school. And so I did go back to college. I did get a degree. I met another man, and we got together and had another baby. And you know, this is, and he's a good guy. My second husband is a really good guy, and he's a good guy to this day. I had the FBI call. He's got a top secret clearance. He was a physicist and ended up with working in defense. And the FBI called me up because he listed me as a reference or an ex-wife. I'm not sure which one. And so I talked to this guy, and he was from Butte, and I had met him on my job. And he's talking to me, and I'm telling him about Michael. And he says at the end of the phone call, he said, "I've never had such a glowing report from an ex-wife ever in my," I said, you know, he's a good guy. It's not his fault that we're not married. You know, it's because of my alcoholism. It's because I can't be faithful. It's because I'm a tramp, and I, you know, and that's hard on a man, you know, wife is not faithful. I mean, I don't know. I don't have firsthand experience, but I can imagine, you know, it's rough on you. And I was what I call brutally honest in those. I mean, I would tell him what I was doing. I would tell him what was going on. And anyway, so so my disease is going on, and I finally met him. I met my match. I met a drunk. And oh Lord, we just put each other through unmitigated. I mean, it was really ugly. And in 1979, Richard says this is impossible. Richard says you can't slap somebody and break a bone, but I don't know. I was drunk, so I don't know what happened, but I was drunk with a friend of mine who has since come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he had gone to the movie, so he was sober, and he come home, and I just was on him, you know, like white on rice, and he turned around. My memory is that he turned around and backhanded me. Richard says, "You can," and I've seen all those Bruce Willis movies where they punch him in the face thousands of times, and nothing ever gets broken, but anyway, this bone right here, my cheekbone, he broke that sucker. And I was so drunk. I mean, I didn't even know it. And he turned around to me at one point and he said, "What happened to your face?" And I said, "What do you mean, what happened to my face?" He said, "Go look in the mirror. My face was swollen out to here." And he said, "If you tell them I hit you, I'm going to jail." I said, "Well, I won't tell them you hit me." And I made up some, I was doing a handstand or something, and you know, I mean, they all looked at me. They all knew that wasn't the truth, but that's what I told them. And the other thing that happened, though, and I think it happened in 1978, was that my second ex-husband came and took the kids. He came and took my children. And that was the beginning of such a horrible, horrible experience for me, because I had been able to act like no big deal, no big deal, no big deal. But when your kids are taken, it's a big deal. It's a big deal. And so he came and took them, and I drank more and I drank more. But the other thing that I started that happened at that time was I started to pray. I started to pray for the will of God. And it turns out I'm terrified of the will of God, because the highest rank in the Catholic Church, forgive me, I don't mean to be irreverent, but the highest rank in the Catholic Church is Virgin Martyr. And even though that ship has sailed a long time ago, and I'd rather be dead than be a virgin, it, you know, that my picture of what was going to happen if it was God's will was, you know, it was bad. It was really bad. And so it only took me 18 months to get honest about that and to say, okay, the will of God and the grace to bear it, which I believe is kind of the essence of the 11th step, though. I didn't know that at the time. And the last 2 years of my drinking is, in my mind, is a picture of what God can do and what God will do to get a person sober, because that's what ended up happening at the end of this, was I got sober, and it was a gift. It was a pure and simple gift. I didn't do anything. I didn't make a decision or a choice. It's just the whole last 2 years is just a study of, you know, losing my kids and having, and I'm in the with this guy, this violent, crazy guy, and I'm violent and crazy too. Don't get me wrong. And he's got another woman on the side. So I start controlling my drinking the last 6 months because, you know, if I get too drunk, he's going to leave with her, because I'm really out of control and I'm drinking by this time. And so I go along and I have the experience I told you about in May, the beginning of May. And just a short time after that, right? Like 8-9 days after that, Mount St. Helens erupted. Now, you guys are on the East Coast. Maybe you don't know anything about that, but it was a big deal. I lived in Missoula, and that ash, I've spoken in Portland since then, that ash all came east. None of it, Portland didn't get any. It all came east, and it settled, a bunch of it settled over the valley where I was living in Missoula. And we couldn't go anywhere for 3 days, and I didn't drink. And by this time, I am really trying to control it. I am really trying to control it. And it's working maybe 10% of the time. I can drink a double shot of Chivas with a water back, and I can nurse that sucker for the evening. And I can do that. Sometimes I can do that. It's not really like controlling your drinking. It's more like just delaying the drunk, you know, that, and that's what I'm doing. And that's the best I can do by this time. And I had that experience with telling that woman about how afraid I was about my drinking. And on June 17th, 1980, I walked into my bathroom and it was like looking in a mirror of a haunted house. It was really bad. And I don't know if you ever looked at a shark's eyes. They're like flat, black, dead. There's no life in there, no life in there. And that's what my eyes looked like. And I said a prayer, and the prayer was also a gift. And I said, God, I can't stop and I can't go on. And you've got to do something. And I felt something lifted off of me, like a big weight came off of me. I did not know what that was at that moment. I've come to believe that that was the urge to drink. He just took it. He just lifted it out of me. Not that I stopped drinking at that moment. I mean, I'm in the middle of a drunk. I don't stop in the middle. I go on to blacking out and puking and picking a fight with him and putting my foot on the floor so the bed doesn't spin, you know, and all of that I do. It's just a typical night of drinking. But I have not drank from that night to this night. And I can't do that. It's impossible for me to do that. I went 8 months without a drink once. It was about one of the worst times in the entire time I drank was that 8 months I didn't drink. And as Jack C. from Hagerstown, Maryland used to say, when I don't drink and I don't change, it's really ugly. And that's what happened to me. That second ex-husband, he left the state. I mean, he stayed through all of the alcoholic insanity and all of that. But when I didn't drink for that 8 months, he left. He lives as close to the Mexican border as you can possibly get and still be in America. And because he couldn't bear it, you know, he couldn't bear me. And the next morning I got up, I went to work. That was unusual in those days. And I came home that night. And 5 o'clock was Miller time and my house was the bar. And so I didn't come home. I went to the pool at the university and I detoxed myself. And I have no clue. See, I have no idea what is going on. None. I don't even know I'm drinking that much. I don't even know I'm that bad. But I would go to and sit in that sauna at the pool and turn that cold water hose on myself and go back in the sun, do that for about an hour before I could go home. That was on a Tuesday night. And I think that day or the next day, that woman that I admitted in the blackout, she came. She came to my job. And that's how we knew each other. And she talked to me about what I said. She told me what I said. And she said, I have a friend and she's sober a year and a half and she would be willing to come and talk to you. And I thought I was fine. I mean, I'm just not drinking now and I'm fine. I have no idea what I have. I have no idea what I'm dealing with. And that was, so the whole thing after that, just become, every time I tell my story, I think, how can you doubt God? How can you even question? Because it's just perfect. It's perfect the way he lined it out for me. D came and sat across the table, gave me a 12 and 12, told me in a general way what she was like, what happened, and what she's like now. And I thought, you know, people don't lie on this side of things. She looked so good. She had nails and her hair and everything matched. And oh my God. And she said, I know a guy here in Missoula and I can hook you up with, he'll call you. And I thought, okay, well, whatever. I think it was when she showed up on Thursday. So Friday, I get this call from this guy. Oh my God, he sounded so old. His name's Cecil Williams. He's gone to the big meeting in the sky. He had 14 years at the time. He was an old Teamster organizer. And I lied to him. He wanted to take me to lunch. I said, you know, I'm sorry, I've got a work meeting I've got to be at. And he, you know, said, okay, well, I'll call you again. And that night, Friday night, I'm a CPA by day and I'm a garbage picker by night. I'm in the parking lot of this law office across from the police department, picking up butts while my boyfriend, who has a janitorial service, is inside cleaning. And the only woman I know in Missoula, Montana, who's been to treatment and is sober, walked by. I mean, if this stuff hadn't happened to me, I wouldn't believe it either, but it did happen to me, and it is what happened. And she was on her way to a Friday night women's meeting. She asked me if I wanted to come. I said, oh no, I haven't had a drink in 3 days. I'm fine. You know, the next Friday, same deal. And in the meantime, all he and I did was fight. I mean, that's all we, because he said to me, if you don't drink, we won't fight so much. Well, he was wrong about that, because we fought like cats and dogs. And I got crazier and crazier and crazier. And by the end of that week, Friday, same deal. Same deal. I'm out there picking the butts and she walks by. Well, that night, thank God I got her phone number and her address. Because the following Friday, my big thing was when I met with Cecil, he had 14 years. And he said to me, he had 14 years. And I thought, how can you do that? And I had 6 days. And he said, I do it a day at a time. And I had hope. That was the first gift I got from Alcoholics Anonymous, was hope. Maybe I could do that. Maybe I could do a day at a time. I was worried about how to get through the 4th of July, because I don't know what you guys do on the 4th of July in Madison, Virginia, but we get drunk and blow stuff up. That's what we do. That's all we do. I don't know anything else to do on the 4th of July. Well, the answer to that question is I go to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. The 4th of July was Friday. And I went to that woman's house and she took me. She brought me to you. She brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I will be forever grateful. I met a woman there. I'm still close friends with. She lives in Chicago by Pete. Name is Mary Mack. And she had the most beautiful blue eyes. And I had the experience that Bill had when he saw Evie. There was something about her eyes. Oh my God, they just sparkled. And they weren't bloodshot. They weren't red. They weren't, you know. And she said my name. She remembered my name. And people in the bars were calling me Fred. They couldn't remember my name. You know, I mean, it just, there, something happened at that meeting. I heard the laughter. I didn't hear the message, but I heard the laughter of Alcoholics Anonymous, and those women hugged me, and I really needed to be hugged. I needed to be hugged. And 3 weeks later, I went to my second meeting. This is not how it works. Okay, do not do it this way. But this is what happened to me. I would go to the bars with him. He would get drunk. I was blacked out the whole time. I didn't even know what was going on, but I watched him. Oh my God, it was awful. He was packing a gun. He was mowing the dirt. It was shooting the couch. It was, and I'm not drinking through all of this. I'm not drinking. So because I belong to a very loving and creative God, he ended up coming to Alcoholics Anonymous and getting sober. And I followed him into AA. So if somebody tells you got to do it for yourself, tell them you know a woman who's got 40 years, who's still waiting to have a noble motive. I'm still waiting to have a noble motive. You know, I just trooped in behind him and I fell in love with you. I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't do spit else, but I went to a lot of meetings. I went to a lot of meetings for about a year. That's all I did. Now, a lot of people can't hang on that long, but I had the gift of desperation. I really did. And I had the grace. I mean, God had done something for me. The other thing you got to know is I held two opposing ideas in my mind. I knew I couldn't stay sober because I tried it before. I tried it for 8 months, you know, and I couldn't do it. I knew I was going to drink. But I thought, I'll just sit in these rooms until I do. The other opposing idea I had was that once you get to AA, you're safe. Once you get to AA, you're safe and you're not ever going to drink again. Well, those are both not true because I didn't drink again, but I watched a lot of people drink again, including that man that I followed into Alcoholics Anonymous. Just let's see, 18 months, finally, I did a fifth step. Finally. Oh God, it was ugly. It was so ugly. And it was not honest. And it was, you know, subpar. but it was good enough. I've had to do subsequent four steps, but I got the result. I mean, I got the result. I didn't drink that day. He did. The day I did my first fifth step, he drank. December 30, 1981. It's the second most important day of my life is the day I did my first fifth step. Because like the promise in the book says, now we begin to have a spiritual experience. And that is what happened to me. Even doing that shoddy, bad job. I mean, I didn't even have the harm done to others. I didn't have it written down. I didn't think I did anything to anybody else, which makes 6, 7, 8, 9 really tough. You know what I mean? Really tough. But I should back up. The way I got to the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and the steps, is that these two guys showed up from out of state, David and Wade. David was Wade's sponsor. They were cowboys. I love cowboys. And I don't think it's just because I'm from Montana either. I think I'd love them no matter where I was from. But they were big book students, and they had the Joe and Charlie tapes. And we would go to David's apartment after the meetings, and we would listen to Joe and Charlie. And I thought they were so lame. You know, I just couldn't even believe how stupid they were and their bad jokes. And some of you know Joe and Charlie. But they opened up that book for me, because before that, it was just a dumb book that somebody wrote a long time ago, and it didn't have anything to do with me. But it opened it up for me. And the pages I remember specifically is page 25, where it says, I can't paraphrase the book. I'm sorry. I just can't do it. We saw that it really worked in others, and we had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we had been living it. And I watched Wade change through the steps. I watched him become a human being, and I wanted to die. By that point, I'm at the same point I was at the end of my drinking. I want to die every day. I go to bed at night. Here's my suicide attempt. I go to bed every night and I say, God, please don't let me wake up in the morning. And I wanted to die. And then the other thing they did, and I know some of you have heard this, but they read the 9-step promises with the words, when I took a drink of alcohol, in front of each of them. And I realized in hearing that reading, because before that, the 9-step promises didn't mean anything to me. They meant I was going to be rich and famous. That's all I got out of them, you know? But when they read them that way, what I got was, I drank for the 9-step promises. This is the effect that alcohol gives me. When it works, it gives me freedom. It gives me incredible freedom. It makes me so, I don't want to die and I don't want to kill you. You know, my whole attitude and outlook on life changes. It changes everything for me. And fear of people and economic insecurity, I'm just not afraid of you. And I'm certainly not afraid of being broke, because as long as I got checks, right, I got money. And so when they read those promises that way, it was the first time they made sense to me. And it made me realize that this is why I drink. I drink for these reasons. Now, I did not think that Alcoholics Anonymous would do for me what alcohol does for me. Do not get me wrong. I worked the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous to prove it wouldn't work. It would not work. It was not going to work, but I was going to do it just to show you it wouldn't work. And nobody is more shocked than me than that this deal works and that I'm still here all this time later. That man ended his own life. He put a bullet in his head from a 22, and I didn't drink. I hooked up with my current husband, but I didn't drink. And I did lots of crazy stuff, but I didn't drink. And I kept coming back. And over time, I have been changed into somebody I don't even recognize. You know, I'm not even that person all the time, much of the time. And I'm so grateful for, I just can't tell you how grateful I am for Alcoholics Anonymous, because nothing else, and I've tried a lot of stuff, nothing else has ever done for me what this does for me. It did it then in the beginning, and it does it today. Mary Mack's sister, we used to call the Missoula group the McDonald clan of Alcoholics Anonymous, because she had, I don't know how many brothers and sisters who were sober. And her sister used to say, God did not open up the gates of heaven and let me in. God opened up the gates of hell and let me out. And that is my experience. The first thing I heard about God that really meant something to me was, because I said, what's the difference between spiritual and religion? You know, you guys are closing the meeting with the Lord's Prayer. How is this not religion? And somebody said to me, pardon my profanity, but said, well, the God of religion will save your soul. The God of AA will save your ass. And that is exactly what has happened to me over the years and continues to happen for me. And I am so, so very grateful. I met Billy, I think, at Pete's meeting in Chicago in September, October. And I was intact. I had long, beautiful hair. It was great. And in December, a routine mammogram turned into a cancer diagnosis and a lumpectomy. And 2 weeks ago, I finished my last, thank you, God, bout of chemo. And this is not a fashion statement on my head. This is covering my baldness. I don't know. Some people are not offended, but I don't take the chance. But the day that they told me they were going to do the needle biopsy, I didn't even have a diagnosis yet. But I know they're not doing needle biopsies for no reason, because they don't think there's anything there. You know what I mean? And I got on my knees in my bedroom and I said, God, I belong to you. You have to take care of me because I belong to you. And I went through that. You know how people say they're praying for you? I've never felt that. I've never felt anybody praying for me. I got to tell you, I feel people praying for me. And I have a lot of people praying for me. I'm on the prayer list in a Jewish synagogue, thanks to my dear Andy, who's here tonight. I've got natives burning sweet grass for me. I've got a woman I graduated from high school who has made me her personal project. She is praying rosaries and novenas and divine chaplet. And I mean, she is busy, this woman is, working on my case. And I am so very grateful, because it's not like I'm not going to have cancer. I have cancer, and the treatment is kind of ongoing. The great thing about breast cancer is it's sort of like alcoholism. It's never gone. You know, they will never tell you that it's cured, you know, that you're over it. So I'm just heading into the next round of treatment with this, but I don't have to have radiation. That's good news. And the really good news for me is that this is the first serious health thing I've ever had in my entire life. Well, in July, I've had macular for years. And in July, my left eye went wet and I started having injections. So once a month I go, you know, it doesn't rain, but it pours, right? And then the cancer thing in December, I'm like, it's like that. Did you guys, I don't know if you guys are Fiddler on the Roof fans, but there's a great line in there when Reptevia says, I know we're the chosen people, but once in a while, couldn't you choose somebody else, you know? And I sort of feel like that, you know, it's like, you know, give me a break. What I've decided is that cancer is a gift wrapped in ugly paper. And the purpose of that gift and all the gifts I've received since I came here is to bring me closer to God. That's the point. That's the only point that I can get at in Alcoholics Anonymous. It doesn't have to be your point, but today it's my point. And it's taken me a long time to get there. I mean, I didn't just get here. You know, I was belligerent and hostile and angry. And I met a guy came to Helena a few years ago, and he said, he came up to me after I shared at a meeting, and he said, my dad and I used to sit in meetings in Missoula and listen to you talk. And he said, you were the most angry, disrespectful, disagreeable, hostile, bad-tempered, mean-spirited person we had ever heard in our lives. And he said, I wish my dad was still alive so he could see how much you've changed. So wherever you are where you are, and you are where you belong. And I'm here to tell you, you can get where God needs you to get from wherever you are. And the only thing I know is that the 12 steps are the only thing I've ever done that have worked to change me besides booze. And they change me and they change me and they keep changing me in ways I don't even know I need to be changed. You know, I don't even know. I don't even get it. But today I get that if God has a refrigerator, my picture's on it. And I know that he loves me. And I know that this is not a punishment. And I'm not angry about, I'm so grateful I'm not angry about it, because I've been angry about everything my whole life, starting with my dead sister. I mean, I've just been mad about all of it. And I'm not mad today. And that is an entire psychic change, I gotta tell you. It just is, you know. I just, so many things have happened. I hated dogs. I hated people who love dogs. I just thought you were so stupid. You couldn't have relationships with real people. So, you know, and my daughter, you know, left me a dog and I fell in love with that sucker. I mean, I just, little Sheltie Mix. Oh, Monty, we just adored him, my husband and I. And now we're on our fourth and fifth dog. You know, I mean, I just can't imagine my life without dogs in it. You know, I've, watch your judgments. You don't know. You might turn into one of those people, you know. I was a football fan for a while. I don't know how I feel. All the injuries are kind of bugging me, so I don't know how I feel about that. But I got to tell you, I have the best life. I found out something a few weeks ago sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with a bunch of newcomers. I found out I'd rather have cancer than be a newcomer. I would. It's a better deal. It's a much better deal. I would rather. People can think I'm crazy, but I don't care. I would rather. So the other thing that my parents, you know, I just brutalized my parents and blamed them for everything that happened in my life. And just, you know, and my dad, turns out I got my dad's gene pool, you know, because he has macular, he has osteo, he had prostate cancer, only one in the family. And I got all of that. I stood in my kitchen a few weeks ago and I said, Dad, I would not give up being your daughter to not have those things, because I love you and I'm grateful for you. And I was a good daughter at the end of my dad's life, you know, and I was able to be a good daughter. And I took care of my mom the last 2 years she was alive. She came and lived with us and she was confined to a wheelchair. And I wasn't the best caregiver in the world, but we did our best, you know, we did our best. So my dad loved country Western music and I hated it because my dad loved it. So it's only fitting that I close every talk I give with this tribute to my dad from Martina McBride. She said, I have been blessed. I feel like I found my way. I thank God for all I've been given at the end of every day. I have been blessed with so much more than I deserve. To be here with the ones who love me, to love you so much, it hurts. I am so blessed. We are so blessed. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much, Carlene. Such a heartfelt talk. Thank you so much for sharing from the heart. And thank all of those who came with you and accompanied you. We thank you for your support for Carlene. We'll close the meeting and others can, we'll open it up and then everyone can thank properly.